OutroCast. Lige, Johnny, thank you both for doing this. I'll first throw it at Johnny. Besides, how are you? Love the show Reboot, and I see a big connection between the character Clay and the character you play in this. Is it just a coincidence, or did you use some of Clay for this one?
All my characters are in recovery.
So is that a yes?
What's that?
Is that a yes? There's a lot of Clay in this role in Sweet Dreams.
No, I think there was a lot of just my life experiences in this role with my friends in recovery, with my father who's an alcoholic. A lot of times I've distracted with one thing or another in my life. So, you know, I have two young daughters and a son. I know what it's like to go through a divorce, unfortunately. And so do they. So there's a lot to draw on.
Well, I'm going to throw to Lige here and say congratulations on the film, but also your acting role in there, which IMDb doesn't have, but we know that it's you in the film. How long did it take from thinking of this film to actually finishing it?
I know exactly how long, actually, because when I thought of this movie, I was with this guy, a friend of mine who I was picking up from sober living. It was 4 years ago. He just celebrated 4 years of being sober. So that's it. 4 years. Birth till now.
Birth till now. Well, the follow-up question, will I ever at any point in time be able to buy a Sweet Creams jersey? Is that
our
marketing plan?
Hold on.
Are they?
Just because you asked. I have a box sitting right next to me. I'll send you one.
Oh, well, I wasn't fishing for that. I just thought it was a mismerchandising opportunity. If it was.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You were correct. It is.
I didn't think of that. See?
Well,
I think there's still time, though. You know, it's going to be online. It's going to live on forever. So,
yeah.
That'd
thanks
be cool.
To Team Paramount. And Johnny, looking at the credits, I see the French cassettes happen to magically be on the soundtrack to this one. I'm assuming that was you, of course.
That was my daughter who also worked on the film. So she's a wheeler and dealer herself. And, you know, the French Cassettes are a great band and really great. And so, you know, it's great to have them in the on the sound in the film. I don't think anyone does. Does anyone do soundtracks anymore?
They do soundtrack. Yeah, there'll be a soundtrack. But it'll be the score, and then
the
film soundtrack will be whoever decides to create one on Spotify.
Yeah.
But that's the music's all people, like so many people in the movie and related to people in the movie. So,
yeah, there's some great background usage of punk stuff that you wouldn't necessarily expect to hear in film, aside from 311. But my question is, that 311 song, was there a backup plan in case All Mixed Up didn't get greenlit?
No. No, you know, Nick's a friend of mine, and I was really hoping that we could pull it off, and it worked out miraculously, and it's that was a really cool thing. You know, I listened to 311 a lot when I was, you know, I mean, that song, everybody for my age, I think everybody knows very, very well. So
I'm
is that
you.
An avocado in the background or Kermit the Frog's butthole? I can't tell.
I took an avocado-shaped balloon from an Avocados to Mexico press event, and 2.5 months later, it hasn't deflated. So I forget it's there. I mean, do you have any avocado balloons in your homes?
No, but by God, I'm going to get some after this.
Well, the ending question for both of you. Johnny, where can we see you next? Are you allowed to say what the next project is?
Yeah, I mean, where can you see me next? I don't know. That's too far down the line. Probably my kid's baseball game.
Or
my daughter's basketball game or volleyball game.
Now I know. And Lige, are you?
But don't come to those games. That would be really uncomfortable.
We'll just look for you on IMDb. That's it.
Okay, thank you.
The final word goes to the director. Are we allowed to know what project's next from you?
I don't ever know what's next, but I know what I'd like to be next. You know, I've got this, you know, my version of Die Hard with a little more grounded and in some comedy in there, that I'd
It's
like to.
called Guy Hard.
Better than Spy Hard with Leslie Nielsen, but the key is congratulations to you both on this film.
Oh, I forgot. I have a podcast coming out called Pretty Sure I Can Fly any day now. It's me and Elmer
Yeah.
Baker. So that's where you can see me next.
I'm glad there's a lot to look forward to from both of you in the near future. But again, congrats on this film. Funny, moving. It could be the evergreen sobriety movie.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
A pleasure to be speaking with you both today. Theta, how's your day going aside
Absolutely.
from answering the same questions over and over and over again from lazy podcasters and writers?
My day is actually it's going so well. There have been very few repeat questions, but my answers are getting better and better.
I
It's
agree. There
always
you
a
go.
wonderful chance to improve.
The follow-up to that is, how did you first find John? Now, if I can editorialize, I've seen John in a trillion things, but once I saw John in the after party, I went, oh, that guy.
Thank God.
Was
I
that
love
shot during COVID?
that
After
was
party?
that
Was a
I
COVID shoot?
you sent me the script when I was on that set.
There
I read the
you
script
go.
in my trailer, doll.
See,
Wow.
so I'm very fortunate. I've known John for a long time, knew John before he was doing things like After Party or Search Party, any of these party-based things that he's
Comedy
been
murder
involved in
mystery.
recently. So I know John from New York theater. Very low tier New York theater.
Well, that's actually something I'm very curious about because going through your credits, John, I know that there's the Ars Nova in your early days. Lots of improv, yet in having an HBO special, you're kind of a stand-up. You have a lot of different job titles with the whole thing. Where you're at right now with being an actor, with being a lead like you are in this film, was that a happy accident or was that the plan all along?
Ooh, well, I mean, you know, yeah, that's the maybe not the plan, but that was the goal. Like that
Yeah.
that or that was the desire was certainly to have like roles that were actually required a little bit more kind of intellectual, emotional curiosity, like and sustained curiosity. I really never get to do what I got to do in this movie. I never get to do it. I mean, Search Party was an example of me playing a role over the course of like 6, 7 years, which was actually surprisingly profound, just the repetition of it. There's something very like human that happens when you do the same thing over and over again. But I so rarely get to do like a lead role that requires like and thankfully this is a very intelligent and ambitious movie, formally and thematically, and it required like lots of discussion. And thankfully Theta and I as friends are already primed to talk a lot, you know? And so we got to kind of get paid for the thing we already do, which is like talk a lot. Not pay very much, to be clear,
I'm paid very well. Yeah, the
but yeah,
conversation
I mean,
was its own reward.
yes. But yes, I was so it was totally thrilling to have something that required kind of a more like theater approach of like rehearsal and table work and discussion and yeah.
And memorization. And
Memorization.
memorization. Well, Theta, you also had to do the memorization thing in playing Carla, not just directing and writing and that kind of a thing. How much of Carla is there in you, the human being?
I think that Larry David has said of his character on Curb Your Enthusiasm that it's like the person he wishes he was. Like, it's not an exact analogy because I know that Carla has many shortcomings, but she is unrestrained in a way that I do actually kind of admire, and I do wish that I had the ability to sort of burst in somewhere where I'm not wanted and like make myself right at home. And I think I don't know. I wrote Carla to be flawed but magnetic. And you get to cheat when you're writing because you can have, I can write somebody, I can write another character being magnetized. I can write it so that Bahlul is fascinated and not repulsed, or that
Right.
Ronald is interested and not horrified.
But before I ask basically the same exact question to John here, what you just said about the Larry David character, as somebody watching Curb Your Enthusiasm, I'm curious about that concept because just about every problem that Larry David gets into, he could have just solved by paying an extra $70. Just about every single thing. So do you think he really wishes that he were more stingy?
No, I think what he wishes is that he wasn't so governed by this by politeness and good manners, which, as I'm sure he is in life, I'm sure he's actually, for all of his ornery, nature, I'm sure he's very polite and that he tips very well. And I'm sure that there's part of that that makes him long for the freedom of just being a bad person, so I don't know, I can really relate to that.
But John, the lazy
He's very
fellow,
polite.
same exact question that you get, the Terry character. How much of Terry is there in you? And the reason I ask that is because your roles are very, very different from project to project. In other words, we can't go, oh, John Early's in that. Okay, he's going to be falling down. Like, we don't know. We do see some physical comedy from you in this role, but that's not in every role. You're very different. You play the part that's needed.
Gosh, that's such a nice compliment, because I of course feel like I'm just always reaching into the same bag of tricks. But I there's a lot of me in Terry, and I think and that was made possible because of Theta's very intimate knowledge of my like deepest insecurities and my my upbringing. I think Terry is like someone who really kind of leads with his kind of charity. He performs a sense of like charity and put uponness, and he really, his like kink is like suffering, and I come from a kind of Protestant upbringing in which that's very much in the water. And so I think Theta really took that and like turned it up and like perverted it in a really, really great way. Also, just like his back pain, I have back problems that Theta incorporated into the script, and that I think is very like symbolically potent. I mean,
I think there's a, oh, go on.
well, I'm just gonna quickly say I think that there, I am always drawn to kind of playing the manic host. I love like the party hosting anxiety, and I think Theta did a beautiful job of like going, well, like okay, if that is John's like kind of strong suit comedically, how can we build that out psychologically, culturally? How can we like choose a whole kind of history for this person that can like celebrate that? I mean, that's the really vain way of looking at Theta's script, obviously. I don't think that was her primary focus.
So
I
bringing
just think,
together though, to rudely interrupt you, Theta,
oh no,
John is Terry hosting the
I just
party,
said
the after party, search party. He's
that.
the party dude.
Yes, and having no fun at any of them. But by the way, I just feel like I should say that in life, John throws a beautiful party and is an amazing
Thank
cook and a
you.
consummate host.
Thank you.
That act, but that the. I actually think there is a way to think about things where you think, well, let's say if they're very similar to something from real life, that maybe 90% of real life is being ported over into the fiction and there's 10% fiction. But what I feel is that if you, the minute you decide that something is fiction, it's 100% fiction, no matter how much superficial resemblance it bears to you, to your psyche, to your real life, you have 100% moved it into the realm of fiction. It's not confessional, it's not journalistic, it's a fiction. And because 1 inch of remove from yourself is all you need to actually find distance and the ability to characterize that person. So, like, I just think that it's like if you try and do something radically different, you go Daniel Day-Lewis with it and wear, do a weird accent and grow weird facial hair, like, okay, that's a certain order of fiction. But I think that you can get there homeopathically just by moving an inch to the right or 6 inches to the right,
So
and you
you're
get a
saying
completely.
professional wrestling is real if I want it to be real?
Yes, I think it's real. Look, as they always say, can you, are my bruises fake? Or is my injuries fake? Is this fake? You want to tell that to my wife and kids when I come home in a neck brace? Is that fake? No,
Valid. Well, the
it's
bottom line
real.
is you both did an excellent job with stress. I can't speak today. Stress positions. Congratulations on the on camera and the behind the scenes work, and really looking forward to what's coming next from both of you in the near future.
Thank
Thank you,
you.
Darren, and thank you, PaltroCast.
Getting this started here, it's an honor and a pleasure to be speaking with you. Big fan
Thank you,
of
man.
your output as an artist for decades, your work as a producer for decades. Obviously, the work you do with Blue Note, you make a difference in that respect as well. But
Thank you,
the
man.
first question I have is, what do I call you in terms of a job position? Do I just say musician, Don was?
Yeah, you can even say bass player. That's kind of how I think of myself.
Yeah, so that is actually one of the first things I wanted to know. In watching the video content that you put out with the Pan Detroit Ensemble, we see you with the upright bass. We saw you with the upright bass in the Ryan Adams Band, etc. What was your journey in going, hey, I'm not an electric, regular four-string person, I'm an upright person for life?
Well, I started on the electric bass. I was just trying to emulate Paul McCartney, who seemed to really be getting over with four strings. And I played that for years. I took some upright lessons when I was in college in 1970 at University of Michigan, but I dropped out before it made a real impact. And then I lost the lessons. I started a band with Ringo Starr in the early 90s. As Ringo, Bemont Tench from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, myself and a guitar player named Mark Goldenberg. And we were looking for a male lead singer. And we called Merle Haggard just for the hell of it, and he said, yeah, come on up to the ranch. So we went up to Redding, California. And we went in his studio. He had a great studio at his house. And he had Bob Moore's acoustic bass, which Bob Moore was like the session guy in Nashville, played on a thousand incredible country records. And somehow Merle had his bass in Northern California. And so he just handed me that thing. And I thought, oh God, I haven't played this, in 40 years. And thankfully the song was in D, so there were a lot of open strings. And I just played really simply, but I'll never forget it. I was standing there, playing in tune on an acoustic bass, looking at Merle Haggard with Ringo Starr right behind him. And it was like a dream. It was like dreaming that you're flying. And I just thought, I gotta buy one of these. And I was starting a record with Merle Haggard or with Kris Kristofferson a couple of days later. So I went out and came back from Merle's place, bought an acoustic bass, and then I love the warmth of it. I love the fact that even if you can't really hear yourself, you can feel the note because it vibrates on your whole body, and you become the note. Kind of, it's really wonderful to be connected with a resonant piece of wood like that. So I just fell in love with it, and I'm still terrible, but I'm
I
getting better.
wouldn't say you're terrible. I mean,
I would, man.
if we're comparing you against, say, Christian McBride or something like that, well, yeah. But the key is you're doing it. You're going through the hassle of carrying an extra, 40 or 50 pounds with you on the road to every gig. Is it, do you get to have the same bass tech that you would for a regular tour?
With Pan Detroit Ensemble, I might just be carrying it in myself from the bus. We're starting from scratch. It's a really exciting
experiment. I haven't done this in decades, you know, just starting a band from scratch. I mean, really since 1980 was the last time I did it. And there's a sound I've been hearing in my head, and I've been chasing it up for decades. And I, you know, I'm 72 now. So I thought, well, you better close in on this thing while you can. So I started getting together with guys in Detroit because I thought, you know, if you're going to start a band, be who you are. Don't try to, you know, you don't want to compete with Christian McBride. You don't want to compete with Ron Carter, but they can't be you either. They didn't grow up in Detroit in the 1960s and go see the MC5 and the Stooges play at the Grandy Ballroom. So incorporate that into your experience. The thing that makes you different from everyone else is your superpower. And so I tried to accentuate the difference. I thought, go back to Detroit, get in a room with a bunch of musicians who grew up the same way as you, and start the musical conversation going. And when we got this particular group of people together just in a room to play last October, it was like, bam, everything clicked. There was nine people, and we were all on the same wavelength. And that just doesn't happen very often. You're lucky if you can find that a couple of times in your life, you know. So I thought, all right, this is it, man. We're going to do this, and we're going to see it through, and we're going to start from scratch. We're going to end up playing to half full rooms because nobody knows what this band is. No one's heard of this band before. Pan Detroit Ensemble, what is that? But we're going to go out there, and we're going to do it. And over a period of time, people are going to come to love this band. And I really believe in it. And I'm thrilled to go out there with a group of musicians that I know we can get some communication going amongst, and to not know where it's going. It's going to turn into something else. This first tour is like about 2.5 weeks, and we'll never be able to get back to this point again, where we go in with beginner's mind, have no idea what's going to happen, but we're pushing the limits every time. I'm really looking forward to the shows. Once you figure it out, you go somewhere else, and it may be someplace better, but it will never have that kind of rawness and focus again.
Yeah, now you called out when it comes to Detroit influences, MC5 and the Stooges, and of course the Amboy Dukes came out of that scene.
Sure did,
And Alice Cooper's happy to talk about how he's from Detroit, even though he's really from Arizona. And then Grand Funk and all that. Being a big David Lee Roth guy, the Bissonette brothers were both Detroit guys. So I think
absolutely,
the roots of Detroit are much wider than people realize. Did you have a certain number of years of your career where you just didn't talk about Detroit?
No, never. Always proud of it, and always proud to be from there, and certainly proud of the musical heritage because it's unlike any other city in history, really. First of all, the music that comes out of Detroit, it has got a special quality to it. You can identify it pretty quickly, and it kind of matches the people of the who live in the city, which is it's very unpretentious, very honest, very straightforward. No gloss, no sheen. It's just real, and you can go listen to me. John Lee Hooker is the epitome of Detroit music, about as raw as blues can get before it falls apart. But so soulful and so powerful, it really gets under your skin. And you go through all the different styles of music that came through there, whether it's the R&B that came through Fortune Records, and then Motown, which even though Motown Records were pop records, if you listen to those, man, those are very raw, honest sounding records. You hear that room and you hear the people in the room, and you can tell that this is not made in New York, you know. But and also the jazz thing, man, on Blue Note, I would say maybe 20% of the artists, going back over the history of the whole company, 20% of our roster came from Detroit. It's shocking how many great jazz musicians came out of Detroit. And you mentioned the rock and roll scene. I'd add Mitch Ryder to that jambalaya as a guy who maybe really one of the first rock and roll guys to bring like legit R&B phrasing into the rock and, you know, the white rock and roll idiom. And he was he's not only an eloquent export of the Detroit sound, but one of the great rock and roll singers to come out of the 1960s altogether.
Yeah, so the before I ask a question about the next generation of the Wuz Clan, the set list is looking like it's going to be, if I'm correct, a mix of things that you produced and jazz and improvisation.
Yeah, but it's also, we got a couple of odd Wuz Not Wuz things thrown in. I did a record with Herbie Hancock and Terrence Blanchard and some of these same guys, Dave McMurray, Luis Resto, in the 90s for Verve. It's called Orchestra Wuz. And so we're doing a song from that album, doing a song from a movie score. I worked on the movie Backbeat, actually won a BAFTA award.
Hey, if I can rudely interrupt you, I've gotten into arguments about how great that soundtrack is. Because
thank you.
Dave Grohl, Dave Perner, and I, when I was at a corporate gig that Mike Mills did, I shouted out, "The Backbeat soundtrack's great," and he looked at me very blankly. But did you know how great of a soundtrack that was while you were working on it?
There was magic. What happened was, it was in that same period when I was doing stuff with Ringo in the 90s, and they offered me the things. The first thing I did was call him up and say, "Do you mind if this if this movie's made, or and B, if I work on it?" And he said, "I wasn't even in the band when that happened, so do whatever you want." He said, "But I'll give you a piece of advice as someone who saw the Beatles play in Hamburg." He said, "Don't try to make it sound like the Beatles albums, the early albums. They were raw. They were a punk band." He said, so, and they were amped up on speed, and it was a whole different thing. So he said, "Get that rawness." So it was, yes, it was an incredible band. It was Thurston Moore, Dave Grohl was playing drums. Dave Perner sang the McCartney parts. And
Mike Mills and Greg Dooley,
yeah, from Afghan Whigs, yeah. And Henry Rollins did a vocal to cover for the one song that Stuart Sutcliffe sang. And when we got those guys in the studio, we cut the whole thing in about 2 days, you know, and we knew it had incredible energy and magic to it. And they got together to do a couple of gigs when the movie came out, and it was powerful. It was a good group. We had a lot of fun.
And it got a weird random MTV Video Music Awards performance as well in that cycle.
Yeah, it was great. I won the BAFTA award for best original score, right? Because I wrote the score music to go along with it. And I didn't know what BAFTA was. So it's the British Oscars, and it's kind of a big deal, but I didn't know what it was. And so they even called us. They said, "You got to go to Scotland and accept this award." So I'm not going all the way to Scotland again. I said, "No, it's the BAFTA Awards. You got to go." And they said, "You won." They even told me I'd won. I didn't go. And some guy got up, accepted the statue for me, and I'd never seen it. Outro cast.